Good evening. I think if everyone can take their seats, we can begin. Welcome. I'm Krista Tippett, and I'm delighted to be here to welcome you to what I think will be an important discussion in the context of a wonderful exhibit. I'd like to thank Elaine Charnoff and Ellen Silberman and their team here at the museum for planning this event. I have wondered if, when the museum planned this exhibit, they knew that the controversy surrounding Darwin's legacy would again take center stage in American culture. Just in these last months, new battle lines have been drawn between science and religion and widely publicized in the news. And this has been kind of startling for me because for the last few years, I've been conducting conversations on public radio in this great city on your terrific public radio station, WNYC. And I have been hearing about a rich new conversation between scientific and religious perspectives that has taken off from astronomy to quantum physics and is in the highest international circles. I think it's worth remembering tonight that before Charles Darwin embarked on his voyage of the Beagle, he considered a career in the church. And opposite the title page of The Origin of Species, Darwin quoted Francis Bacon with these words, "Let no man think or maintain that a man can search too far or be too well studied in the books of God's word or in the books of God's works, but rather let men endeavor an endless progress or proficience in both." So Darwin gives us one way to think about the purpose of this discussion tonight. We're here to explore the interplay between what Bacon called the books of God's word, sacred text and tradition, and the books of God's works, the natural world as observed and explained by science. Tonight, we'll begin by exploring this interplay, exploring how it looks in four lives. We have on the panel two biologists, a physicist, and a theologian. Together, they have roots in Roman Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and Hindu traditions. The ubiquitous opinion polls in our culture say that Americans are fairly equally split between those who accept a biblical creationist account of life and those who accept the scientific explanation that life evolved over time. But our four panelists reject that kind of either-or choice. I would paraphrase some questions that they have asked in their writing. Does it follow that if living organisms can be explained in material terms, there is no room left for a creator behind the universe? Are science and religion descriptions of the same reality, but at different levels and employing different vocabulary? Perhaps science and religion are distinctly equipped to answer different questions raised by life in this world, with the discoveries of science describing how the world works, and the insights of faith addressing the quintessential human question, why? Is science, in fact, one of the loftiest expressions of the human spirit? Is it possible that evolution does not deny the biblical account, but completes it? We'll begin this evening with short presentations from each of the panelists. I've asked each of them to say something about their way of coming at what we've come to think in our culture as the science-religion divide. We'll speak among ourselves for a little while, and then we'd like to open the discussion up and invite your questions and comments. So let me introduce who you'll be hearing tonight. This is Kenneth Miller, a professor of biology at Brown University. He is the author of high school and college biology textbooks, which are used by millions of students nationwide, and he's also the author of Finding Darwin's God, a scientist's search for common ground between God and evolution. To my right is Robert Pollack, a professor of biological sciences and director of the Center for the Study of Science and Religion at Columbia University. His most recent book is The Faith of Biology and the Biology of Faith, Order, Meaning, and Free Will in Modern Science. To my left is Vivi Raman. He is Professor Emeritus of Physics and Humanities at the Rochester Institute of Technology. His books include Glimpses of Ancient Science and Scientists. And this is Nancy Murphy, a professor of Christian philosophy at the Fuller Theological Seminary in California. Her books include Theology in the Age of Scientific Reasoning, and she informed me just before we began that she has a new book that's just been accepted for publication called Did My Neurons Make Me Do It? And we will begin tonight with Kenneth Miller.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank members of the panel, the museum, for making tonight possible, and also for all of you for coming. I also want to apologize for my fellow panelists for being the only one who's bringing a computer display. Being a microscopist by training, I find it impossible to speak without slides, and I apologize for that. I'm going to take the prerogative of having a wireless mic to step out of the way of my own slides. I'm a cell biologist. I work on the structure and function of biological membranes. So how does a nice experimental scientist end up on a panel like this? Well, one of the ways is to start writing textbooks, which are used, as you heard before, in high schools across the country. Why are textbooks like that relevant? They're relevant in part because occasionally they get stickers slapped on them, warning students, as this one did in Georgia, that evolution is a theory, not a fact. It should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. This particular action was the object of a federal trial about a year and a half ago, a trial which was concluded successfully on behalf of parents who saw warning stickers like this placed on my book and on some others as an attempt to impose a particular religious point of view. And the great irony is that all of this happens at a time when the evidence for common descent and descent with modification has never been stronger. And as tempting as it might be to wax into biologist mode and give a lecture on this, I just want to show you one little piece of evidence. For 6 or 7 months, we've had the complete DNA sequence of the chimpanzee genome. And one of the striking things about this is it now becomes absolutely impossible to deny any further that our species is the product of common descent with other species. I want to show you exactly what I mean by that. Biologists have surmised ever since Darwin that we share a common ancestor with the other great apes, including the gorilla, the orangutan, and the chimpanzee. That, as it turns out, is a testable hypothesis, not conjecture, but a testable hypothesis. And the reason for that is we have 46 chromosomes. The other great apes have 48. If we really do share a common ancestor, that common ancestor must also have had 48 chromosomes. So how did we get down to 46? Now, we actually have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Each of us got 23 from mom and 23 from dad. Could we have simply lost a pair of chromosomes? Well, the answer is that's not possible. We know too much about primate genetics, and we appreciate that the loss of an entire chromosome would be fatal to any of these primates and would be fatal to us. Therefore, there's only one possibility for what happened to that extra pair of chromosomes, and that is that in our descent, two chromosomes that were separate in the primate ancestors, which we share with the other great apes, must have become fused together to form a single chromosome. Now, if that is correct, and this is why it's a testable prediction, we should be able to look at our genome and find a chromosome that has been cobbled together from two primate chromosomes. We ought to find the scotch tape that's holding those two pieces together. And a biologist would tell you that's not going to be hard to do. And the reason for that is that chromosomes have special DNA sequences at their tips called telomeres. If a chromosome became fused together, we should find telomere DNA where it doesn't belong, right in the middle of the chromosome. That fused chromosome should also have two other DNA sequences called centromeres. Chromosomes are only supposed to have one. So what we would expect to find in a fused chromosome are two centromeres, one of which might be inactivated, and telomeres at the center. And if we do not find that, evolution might be wrong. But if we do find it, we have tested our hypothesis and evolution has passed it. Well, it's chromosome number two. And I'll just read very briefly from this paper from Nature last year. Chromosome 2 is unique to the human lineage of evolution, having emerged as a result of the head-to-head fusion of two chromosomes that remain separate in other primates. Where are those pieces of scotch tape? They are at base 114,455,823 in chromosome number 2. Look at this. Multiple subtelomeric duplications during the formation of our chromosome 2. One of two centromeres became inactivated. That is chimp chromosome 12 in terms of how it corresponds. Our chromosome number 2 is the amalgam of primate chromosomes 12 and 13. There is no way to explain the organization of that human chromosome by direct intelligent design unless one wishes to presuppose that the designer wanted to fool us for some reason or another. I can find a scientific reason to reject that, but as you'll see, I can find theological reasons to reject that. So why isn't this evidence generally accepted? And why do scientists like myself wind up in the courtroom occasionally, as this sketch from the Dover, Pennsylvania trial earlier last year showed? And as it turns out, resistance to this idea is strongly motivated by religious opposition to evolution. And that is really the only way to cast this argument. And just to show exactly what I mean, this is a quotation from the judge's decision in the Dover trial. And here are two members of the Dover Board of Education who came in front of the court and swore under oath that their decision to teach intelligent design in Dover had nothing to do with religion and they were not religiously motivated. And what the judge said was that citizens in the area were very poorly served by these people, and it's ironic that these individuals who proudly boasted about their religious convictions in public would time and time again lie, and that's the judge's word, to cover their tracks and disguise the real purpose behind the intelligent design policy. What was the real purpose? It was religious. I'd like to show you the voice of an authority on religion who agrees with me on this point.
Last month, the people of Dover, Pennsylvania voted to dismiss school board members who supported the theory of intelligent design. But according to some people, that's not all they voted out.
I'd like to say to the good citizens of Dover, if there is a disaster in your area, don't turn to God. You just voted God out of your city.
You know, I never thought I'd say this. Pat Robertson got it exactly right. This really is a religious issue, and this was the point. And I want to show you one other video clip from a television show taped in this town only a few weeks ago, in which it is amazing how quickly a discussion on evolution gets right to the heart of the matter, which, as it turns out, is religion.
Our guest is a professor of biology at Brown University and a leading critic of intelligent design. I'm going to ask him where he gets off. Please welcome Ken Miller. Thank you so much for doing the show. This is
such
a thrill for me.
It's a thrill for me.
You're a Catholic.
Yes, sir.
I am a Catholic also. Have you forgot the creed? Jesus, through him all things were made.
For us men and for our salvation. I remember
exactly.
All this very well.
Okay.
But there's
so
also...
don't you see a conflict there? You got to choose.
No, there's not a conflict. There's not a conflict.
There isn't?
And you don't have to choose. And here's the problem. The biggest thing that the opponents of evolution have going for them is a fiction. It's not true. And that is the idea that evolution and religion have to be in opposition to each other. Mm-hmm. What it amounts to, in a sense, is that I have a higher opinion of God than the people who favor intelligent design, because they think he's sort of a little pedestrian God who has a lot of cheap tricks. He had to design this. Whoops, it went extinct. He designed that. It went extinct. The fossil museums of the world are filled with his mistakes. My view is that I've got a higher opinion. This is a guy who was so clever that he set a process in motion that gave rise to everything on this planet, and you and me and maybe even Bill O'Reilly.
You know what?
Thank you. What can you say after that? I wanted to sort of close my brief remarks at the beginning by pointing out how pervasive the iconography of conflict is between religion and science, and particular between the idea of creation and evolution. Type creation and evolution into Google. You will come up to websites that show that this is an either-or proposition. I'm sure lots of you know ichthos, the Christian symbol of redemption, the fish. Well, it turns out that either-or proposition even extends to weighing a textbook on biology, mine as it turns out, against Scripture. Although my co-author, Joe Levine, pointed out with a great deal of glee that apparently it takes two Bibles to outweigh our textbook, for which we were very happy. I'm sure you know that evolutionists have a sense of humor, and many of you may have seen the Darwin fish, which is a takeoff on the Christian fish with little incipient legs. Well, Christians have a sense of humor too, and you may have seen the truth fish eating the Darwin fish. And if I had to put one of these on the back of my pickup truck, it would probably be this one, which is the Jesus fish kissing the Darwin fish. And just to let you know that I think this is a serious academic subject, I routinely recommend to my undergraduate students who are anticipating graduate school that if they're thinking about where's their PhD dissertation going to be, they should start with the fish. And to help them out, I've constructed a preliminary genealogy showing the various ways in which the fish can be understood. Some of you may know that there are formidable evolutionary challenges to this, not the least of which is the outgroup, the flying spaghetti monster. And since I am back again in New York City, a place I love to visit, I also have to confess that about 2 months ago, I had the honor of speaking at Yeshiva University, and a couple of students came up afterwards and said, "We like your talk very much, but you're missing a very important fish." And they pointed it out to me, and they were absolutely right. I just added it. Thank you very much.
Bob Pollack, any fish you'd like to add?
In vaudeville, there's a phrase, you never follow a banjo act with another banjo act. So I don't have a banjo act. I'd like to begin with a quotation from Albert Einstein, who is, I think we'll agree, the greatest scientific mind anyone alive has known. When these words were recorded in the autumn of 1940, which was the season and the year of my birth, Einstein was a German-Swiss emigre to the United States, speaking in English in his exile to faculty and students at the Union Theological Seminary in New York City, where I now teach a course called DNA, Evolution, and the Soul. Einstein said, quote, "A religious person is devout in the sense that he has no doubt of the significance and loftiness of those superpersonal objects and goals which neither require nor are capable of rational foundation. They exist with the same matter-of-factness as he himself. In this sense, religion is the age-old endeavor of mankind to become clearly and completely conscious of these values and goals and constantly to strengthen and extend their effects." So the question for, end quote. So the question for me tonight is simply this. Does the science one does, do the facts one recovers from nature through science, require one to have any of Einstein's, quote, super personal objects and goals which neither require nor are capable of rational foundation, end quote. The question to me answers itself because for the sciences and for the facts it discovers, the answer is clearly no. But for the scientist and for the society in which she hopes to live out her life at peace and in good health, The answer equally clearly is yes. And the reason is equally straightforward. Because this natural world, as we understand it from science, is not a place of kindness, nor of natural love. Rather, it is a place full of what theologians have come to call natural evil. And it is incumbent on any scientist to be sure that she or he does not add to that background noise of natural evil with any level of avoidable human evil. Religious thought has two terms that must be brought into play here for me to explain why I am a religious scientist. These are theodicy and eschatology, big words. Theodicy refers to matters that seem to challenge the notion of a God that is at once all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. Students of theodicy distinguish between challenges of this sort that arise from our own avoidable actions, think Auschwitz, and the challenges that emerge unbidden and unchosen from nature. Think of the suffering victims of the tsunami, or of the city of New Orleans, so like the city of Nineveh after Katrina broke her dikes, or of any sick child. Of these two kinds of evil, the challenges from nature are by far the most difficult for us to fathom, as they are the ones we cannot control by making the right choices. Human evil made an evacuation plan that had no place in it for people too poor or sick to drive out of the city on their own before natural evil overspilled the levees of New Orleans. Eschatology deals with matters of endings, in particular with the implications of the notion that this world may end, but that if it does, it will not be the end of us. Intelligent design, by arguing for the evidence of design in this world, seems to have little to say about eschatology. But on reflection, it is probably of interest to most people precisely as an expression of a particular eschatology, in which the theodicy problem above is reduced in importance by the notion that all suffering in this world, though it might well be part of God's design, is but a preamble for a world to come in which a totally new intelligent design will provide all the solace and peace and love of which nature seems so severely depleted. Well, as a religious scientist, I am sure that we can run, but I do not think that we can hide from natural design. Natural design is the absence of purpose, the impossibility of perfection, and the centrality of individual mortality we find in Darwin's fully confirmed model of natural selection. Natural design is the way things are in nature. All that remains is to acknowledge it and to act accordingly. And that's actually not a small thing. There is nothing in this natural design that prevents us from choosing to act in ways that ameliorate the punitive consequences of natural design. Rather, natural design gives us all our common humanity. Ken just spoke to that, and I agree. That's the most significant thing we can say from Darwin, I think. And with our common humanity, our natural and absolute dependence upon the goodness of others for the entirety of our mortal lives. But we cannot begin to know how to choose to act in good and helpful ways, let alone to take proper action, until we acknowledge the reality of natural design. This is why, as an article of faith, intelligent design is truly powerful and deeply troubling. As science, it is meaningless. Nothing in nature supports it, nothing in nature demands it, nothing we can do will either prove or disprove it. But as a belief, it distracts us all from the acts that we, as individuals, as families, as faiths, as nations, and even as a species, that we can perform in this world to diminish the catastrophic consequences of natural disasters and human cruelties. The problem with accepting natural design instead as a reason sufficient to demand our actions is that our inevitable mortality lies at its very heart, no matter how we choose to act, a fact of exquisite painfulness. One way to avoid the pain is to deny the fact. Intelligent design is neither meaningful as science nor helpful as religion, but it is an effective way of putting off the task of thinking through the reality that we must act, even though we and every other living thing we live among have all emerged through a process built entirely on the certainty of eventual death at every level, from cells to individuals to populations to species, including our own. We must, I think, stop trying to escape the burden of theodicy by reducing God's purposes to ones we can easily understand. We can then look again at natural design with neither fear nor false certainty about matters we cannot know. And to do that, it helps a great deal to have in one's heart and mind precisely those supernatural, superpersonal objects and goals which neither require nor are capable of rational foundation. Ian McEwan, a fiction writer, in his 1987 novel, A Child in Time, says of a senior civil servant in England at that time, quote, "The art of bad government was to sever the line between public policy and intimate feeling, the instinct for what is right," end quote. At a time when the line seems quite completely severed in this country, if not in the world, I think we must, as scientists, try to understand and teach how to correct this scandal of neglect and denial that embarrasses our science and trivializes our faith. And that requires, in my experience, a novel form of pedagogy in which one does not teach to relieve ignorance, but rather to provide a means for someone to admit a fact they already know but find too disturbing to confront. In my own work, I've been pleased to find that when we teach the facts of science to clergy, we witness a transformation, that understanding of the data of science enable clergy to put to rest their common fears of the process of modern science. So, in conclusion, my way to close the gap that Krista mentioned does not really exist in everyone, does not exist in me, I think. My way to close it has been to provide clergy with powerful tools to keep alive our shared, embodied, religious, and scientific obligations to preserve a just and functional natural order. Thank you.
Okay. Nancy Murphy.
Well, I decided I would speak a little bit autobiographically because as I tell the story of my travels through various stations in academia, it takes you across the landscape of the theological world, the Christian theological world, as it pertains to relationships with science. I, like Ken Miller, grew up Catholic, went to Catholic schools from kindergarten through 12th grade, and it's interesting, now that I know about all of the difficulties with the theory of evolution, when I look back, I can't even remember for sure which grade I was in when I was taught evolutionary theory. It was just such a non-event. I was pleased that it explained funny details of my horse's legs, but it certainly didn't seem to conflict with anything in religion class. I simply thought, okay, God created all the animals. Darwin tells us how he did it. I went from there to a Jesuit university. Again, there was no hint of conflict. I believe I went to Mass with my biology professors. From there, I went to the University of California, Berkeley, to study philosophy of science. But while I was there, I decided that I was actually more interested in questions that fall within the purview of the philosophy of religion. But there weren't any resources pursue them. Am I gone?
You're back.
All right, I'm back. So I went to the Graduate Theological Union, which is a consortium of liberal Protestant seminaries and three Catholic seminaries, and I studied theology and philosophy of religion there. And a very interesting part of my theological education was discovering the history of the strategy that liberals, mostly Protestants, had used in order to evade conflict between theology and science. And this essentially involved a reinterpretation of the very nature of religion and theology. One of my teachers called it a Copernican revolution. Theology no longer talks directly about God or the world. Theology is basically about human religious awareness. And so Friedrich Schleiermacher, the so-called father of modern liberal theology, says that every event is a miracle as viewed from the religious side, but every event is a natural event as viewed from the side of science. And so if you understand theology and religion correctly, you recognize that there's no possible conflict between these two ways of looking at reality. Well, I was rather shocked by the extent to which theology and religion had been redefined. But just at that time, along came Robert John, who founded the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences, right there in the center of that liberal seminary. And he challenged the liberal orthodoxy by insisting that theology and science can, in fact, and should, and must interrelate. And so the work of his center has been quite a lot of the motivation for my getting involved in this area. After the liberal GTU, I went to teach at Fuller Theological Seminary. Now, on a spectrum of Protestants from fundamentalist to liberal, evangelicals are sort of the fat strip in the center. And so I didn't really know what to expect from my students, but since I've been there, I've come to estimate that about a third of my students in this centrist group are convinced that they can't believe both Christianity and evolutionary theory. And in fact, I know a biology professor who teaches nearby in Southern California who claims that something like 90% of his freshman students come into his class believing that there's a conflict. So these are Christians who believe that theology is just as much about the world as science is, but unfortunately, they see the Bible and the sciences as giving conflicting accounts in many cases. So why do the conservative Protestants see conflict, whereas my also conservative Catholic school friends did not? I think that the rational response is to think that the Bible tells us that God creates, science tells us what the process must have looked like while God was doing that. That is, it seems to me that opponents of evolution are being taught that there is a conflict. And one wonders about the motives for doing that, since it's clearly so destructive. Young people get good science educations and think then that they have to give up the church. And I think that's just tragic. Events like these that give people a chance to hear the missing voices, the ones who see compatibility between science and religion, they are so important in our culture, and I'm so grateful for the organizers having given us the chance to come and share our points of view with you.
V.V. Raman.
There are millions of species that live and die on this planet, and each species is unique in its own way. And what is unique about Homo sapiens, I think, is the enormous complexity of the brain, which enables them to have a tremendously rich variety of experiences. We not only eat and drink, procreate and propagate like all other creatures, but we reflect and rejoice, we love and hate, we conceptualize truth and justice, and do a thousand other things that are mentally, morally, and spiritually uplifting. And of these, science and religion happen to be perhaps the most lofty expressions of the human spirit. Science is a collective effort to understand and explain practically every facet of the physical universe. by its meticulous methodology, science has not only shown the causes of 1,000 phenomena that we observe every day, but it has also unveiled the magic of the microcosm, the molecular basis of life, the magnificence of galaxies that are invisible to the naked eye, and much, much more. Religions, on the other hand, arise from the recognition of the significance, perhaps the uniqueness, of human consciousness in an apparently cold and callous universe. Religions have fostered caring and compassion. They have formulated ethical principles that constrain our natural instincts for self-gratification. They have led to profound and fascinating metaphysics. They have given rise to magnificent architectures as places of worship. But beyond that, religions carry the weight of traditions, because according to the sacred history that is deeply etched in billions of humans, religions arose from the mystic visions of sage poets in India. Religions arose from the covenant of Moses with God, of the enlightenment of the Buddha, of the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, of the revelations to Prophet Muhammad, and such other milestones, major milestones in humanity's heritage. So the question that arises in dialogues between science and religion is, what exactly is primary? Matter and energy, such as science maintains, or consciousness? Because according to science, consciousness is no more than a byproduct of the complex brain, which is itself an accidental formation in the random processes that are constantly occurring in the world. We are, if anything, glitches in the universe story, a mere twinkle in the stretch of time. And yet, we also realize that this universe of ours would be dark and dismal as a dungeon were it not for human consciousness. Planets and stars, vibrations and waves would all be cast in a dark wilderness, as it were, if there were no human beings. The glory of the sunset, the fragrance of jasmine, the sweetness of honey are all aspects of our universe because of our presence, because all the light and color, the beauty and splendor of the universe occurs in the human head. There can be no mathematics or music, no art or even science without human consciousness. So it would seem that the presence of consciousness in the universe is at least as significant as those of double stars and spiral galaxies. And so we understand that religion reminds us that we are descended not only, as science tells us, from apes, but also from philosophers and prophets. And if science tells us that the material matter of which our bodies are made came from high heavens in the heart of supernovas, religions remind us that the consciousness that is in us has also some kind of a cosmic connection. And so we find that science and religion both have an important role to play in all cultures and civilizations, but it is important to understand what these roles are, and more important to understand what these roles are not. because it seems to me that religion has nothing to do with the explanation of natural phenomena. No religion can really tell us how the universe arose or how the first palpitations of life arose. And I believe it is not the role of religion, of any particular religion, to intrude into the affairs of the state or into the worldviews of science. Nor can science guide us as to what is right and what is wrong. And I don't think science can ever tell us why there is this endless persistence of matter and energy, pointless persistence, as it were, for eons, with consciousness thrown in between just for a short span of time. So as I see it, science is the effort of the finite mind to grasp the infinite complexity which we find around ourselves. And religion, on the other hand, is a contemplation of the mystery behind that infinite complexity. Both science and religion inculcate in us great respect and wonderment and awe at this magnificent universe. And they both encourage us to respect the flora and the fauna that enrich the planet on which we live. And religion also adds a little bit of reverence for the forces and factors that science has revealed as the basis of life here on the planet and for the order in the universe. My own religious upbringing inclines me, therefore, to respect the faith of others, the faith that gives meaning and comfort to millions of people, insofar as that faith is not hurtful to anyone. My scientific upbringing makes me respect equally the knowledge that science has brought to humanity, as long as that knowledge is not misused. And above all, I am grateful to the unfathomable mystery that has given me a slender slice of time in eternity to experience this world of marvel and wonder, and also to experience a life of love and laughter. Thank you.
I had wanted to ask you, Vivi Raman, and also Bob Pollack as well, the way we tend to frame this discussion, this debate, this divide in our public life tends to very much revolve around Christian religiosity and particular types of Christian religiosity. And I wonder, and I think you also, you just painted a picture which came at this from a different perspective. We all heard that. You opened it up a bit. But, you know, what is missing for you in terms of what your questions and observations are when we discuss this subject in public?
I won't say what I find missing, but what I can say is that the conflict between science and religion that we find in the Western world is, in a sense of recent origin, by which I mean since the beginning of the Copernican Revolution. In all classical cultures, science and religion, as you know, have gone hand in hand. The same people who explained the world were also the religious leaders. But at that time, and it still continues to be so in many other cultures, religion was also explaining natural phenomena. And the advent of modern science somehow took away that role from science, from religion. And it is that usurpation of a prerogative that is the key to understanding the conflicts that have gone again and again, gone on. Because it seems to me that once the explanatory dimension or role of religion is taken away, there can certainly be harmony between science and religion.
Mm-hmm. Can I?
Yes.
I don't think that there is any aspect of the solace or the mystery of religion that I feel uncomfortable as being absent from these discussions, this or any other. What I feel uncomfortable with is the misconstruing of the natural world as described by science. I am troubled by and frustrated by the notion that natural selection is a random or accidental process. It is a really serious confusion to speak of the randomness of the variability of genetic information being copied, the typos in the construction of new generations of DNA. That's random. But natural selection is a sieve through which only greater viability of offspring can survive. It is, in a sense, the lottery ticket pack that living things buy, that the winning ticket is not random. The winning ticket is a DNA encoding, a behavior or a structure or some other aspect of life that vests offspring with a greater chance of survival. So we are not the product of accident any more than a car driving is the product of kinetic energy released from the breaking of bonds in the gasoline. We go in a direction selected for. Natural selection is natural and selective. That's really quite remarkable because what it says is, not in terms of mass or energy, but in terms of information content, likelihood or improbability, every living thing is absurdly unlikely. The design space of information available in DNA is enormously greater. The number of possible DNAs the size of one of those chromosomes that Ken showed is enormously greater than the number of elementary particles in the known universe. So the available possibilities for life are much, much greater than the ones that have survived. Most DNAs will never live and never have lived.
And does that lead you to theological questions?
Well, it leads me to awe and regard for the unlikeliness of being alive and a necessity, an obligation to figure out what difference does it make? What makes a life a good life? What makes a life of service as opposed to the more natural life of survival? We are wholly unnatural, Krista. What I'm saying, our DNAs, the DNAs of the human species are found in 6 or 7 billion versions. The DNAs of the primates like the chimps and bonobos that Ken referred to are found in 100,000 versions or maybe a couple of 100,000 versions because that's the size of those species. So culture, civilization, mental constructs. Darwin called the mind an excretion of the brain. That excretion has worked very well to enhance our viability. It's very much more quickly than changes in DNA, all of which is to say, what I find as the proof text in answer to your question, is the meaning of the exile from the Garden of Eden. In the exile from the Garden of Eden, the acquisition of the capacity to ask what is right and what is wrong leads to the expulsion from Eden of the first man and woman. They acquire mortality, sexuality, hunger, suffering, death, all at once. And the punishment is not all of those things. The punishment is to still carry with them this heavenly gift of the capacity to distinguish right from wrong. That gift makes humans unnatural, I think, and requires us to have either a religion or the formal equivalent of it simply to make it through this otherwise impossibly disturbing thing called being alive.
But I think, you know, what you're talking about there is a way of reading the book of Genesis and talking about what that means, which is not the standard argument that's thrown out in some of our public debates.
No, religion's not a popularity contest.
Right. But you're talking about seeing in the book of Genesis not an account of how the world came to be primarily, or that's not what for you is essentially important. What's essentially important is an account of human beings asking questions of what is right and what is wrong.
An account of that as a punishment. An account of that as outside of nature. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we would be like the rest of creation. An account that remarks in a pre-scientific age, by clear-sighted recording of the writers of that text, whether by revelation or by being early scientists, that there's something odd about human beings. They ask a question which is not found in nature. It is as if we are in exile from a better place. That's different from the eschatological question of whether we ever get back there, but it certainly feels as though we are not fully prepared for the facts of nature. The facts of nature are Hurricane Katrina. The facts of nature are death. We do better than that. Why do we do better than that? Other species seem not to be bothered to do better than that. I think that is how I answer the question of what's missing. What's missing is a fair consideration of how much science tells us about ourselves, which is consistent with that vision of exile into mortality.
Kenneth Miller, I wanted to push you up a bit to talk about how you bring these two sides of yourself together. You can't hear me?
Pick up your mic.
Where is it? Okay. Let me find my mic.
There you go.
This is not the kind of mic I usually work with.
That's good.
Is that better? I wanted to push you a bit to talk about how you bring these two sides of yourself together, which you've written a great deal about. And specifically, this is something from your book, Darwin's God. To me, the idea of God, the idea of a supreme being, is the intellectual peg that holds everything else together. Say something about that.
Well, I'll try. I'm going to start, by rejecting the premise of your question, which is, how do you bring these two sides of yourself together? Because I think the root of the difficulties that we have in this country and that exist in many Western countries is this notion of a duality of human experience. That the scientific understanding and the scientific experience, scientific project, is different from the theological or the spiritual project. And I think my late friend Stephen Jay Gould wrote, I think, a wonderful and thoughtful book called Rocks of Ages. And he thought very deeply about the exact issue. And he decided that the best solution was the Berlin Wall, which is that we would put a wall of separation between the scientific side of our experience and the spiritual side. He called them non-overlapping magisteria. And again, it was a deep and profound and thoughtful book. But I think ultimately it was a case of running up the white flag. Because I think that all of human experience and all of human knowledge is one. And science and religion ultimately complement each other. And I never feel that I'm not a religious person when I'm in the laboratory, and I never feel that I'm not a scientist when I'm in church. And I think the key value here is to appreciate not that these are two sides, but that these are, in a way, two descriptions which cannot be separated by a wall, but are intertwined like a bush growing through a fence. And neither one can be pulled away from that without making it incomplete. One of the other things I wrote in that book, to paraphrase myself inexactly, is that the God of Abraham doesn't tell us which proteins control the cell cycle. And it doesn't tell us the forces that move chromosomes apart during cell division. But that God does give us a reason to prefer knowledge to ignorance, and does give us a motivation to find out, and does give us a great reward. And that great reward is sort of the beauty of truth and the beauty of understanding of nature. And that's the way in which I put these two ideas together, because I think they're ultimately the same idea.
Nancy, what are you thinking as you listen?
Well, this is going to be boring because I agree so thoroughly. And perhaps it goes back to our Catholic heritage, because coming out of the Middle Ages with the great synthesis of Aristotelian science and Christian theology, Catholics, I think, have always been more hopeful about the possibility of working science, politics, religion, art, all of culture into some sort of a synthesis. And of course, that there have been chinks along the way in the modern period, but I think still there's a greater optimism there. But thinking about being a religious person and a scientist at the same time, the only experience I've had where those two roles were somewhat in tension is while I was studying philosophy of science at UC Berkeley, I was concentrating particularly on how you tell the difference between a well-supported theory and a badly supported theory. And what you're always trying to do is to find some fact that one theory can explain while its competitor cannot. Well, at the same time that I was studying all of this hard-nosed rationalist philosophy, I joined what even most Christians would think of as one of the most naive manifestations of Christian life, which was the charismatic renewal. And so there I would be on Thursday nights at the prayer meetings, participating about 95% of the time, and about 5% of the time thinking, are there any things going on here that would confirm the Holy Spirit hypothesis and disconfirm the hypothesis that we're all just a bunch of susceptible nuts?
Did you come up with an answer?
Well, yeah. You can always say that it's coincidence, but when coincidences pile up in a way that seems coincidentally too many, it begins to look like the coincidence hypothesis is the ad hoc hypothesis. But what was most convincing to me, if the alternative explanation for what would happen at these meetings was that we were all suggestible, then you would expect people to be prayed for healing, and the placebo effect would work, and they would get better. So that's not very interesting. But before the meetings, we always took time at home alone to prepare, and we each felt that we were being given something from God to bring to the meeting. And what we recognized week after week after week was that when we put all of those pieces together with no planning ahead of time, there almost always emerged a very coherent theme and message in the meeting. And that seemed to, although that's a kind of vague kind of evidence, it was one of the most convincing factors for me in believing that there was, in fact, a spirit guiding our participation.
Can I just say something to
you? Yes.
I heard you say that there are no sides in this discussion, and I think we all agree there's no side that separates our religious and our scientific curiosity. But there is a side in this. Both religion and science as practiced are individual acts. And there is a state version of each, which is the other side of both. And I think it's extremely important to say that so far, I think we've all spoken as individuals about our own individual sense of the natural world and our own individual work, either religious or scientific work, in either world. The matter of state-authorized religion and state-authorized scientific results is a corruption of both science and religion. And as a congressman recently said, I wish I remember his name, when one is elected in this country, one puts a hand on a Bible and swears to uphold the Constitution, not the other way around.